So, good morning. Nice to see everyone. As I was saying to Ellie, before, that for years I've wanted to either be or teach at this, and it has never worked out, so I'm very excited to be here, and actually only wish I could stay all day, because it's such a great day. So, I'm Sari Laufer. I'm the Associate Rabbi at Congregation Road of Sholem on West 83rd, and when I was asked to teach, I think there's like a great theme for the day, and I think any teacher probably asks all of them, there's the like, oh God, what do I teach, right? What can I bring? And I went back and forth, and luckily I was coming in on the later end, so a lot of the classes had already been decided, and I noticed a lot of people were already teaching some of the stuff that I might have initially gravitated towards. And so I thought to myself, I thought back to actually probably the first story in Gemara that really sort of lit a fire under me of text that I could find and wrestle with and have conversation with, and it's a text some of you are probably quite familiar with, which is this the Tanur Shel Achnai, the Oven of Achnai. And I realized, and if you're not familiar with it, we're going to have a little bit of time with it. And I realized that the thing that I always found most interesting about it was the bat kol. The translation is daughter of a voice, but usually sort of translated as a voice from heaven, some sort of mysterious voice that calls out. And I was always fascinated by the role of the bat kol, particularly in that story, and sort of what happens to and with the bat kol. And so I thought to myself, oh, there's probably actually a number of other stories, even some that I can think of and some that I might not know already, which is always the best kind of teaching to do when you actually get to learn it along with preparing. And so I thought to myself, let's talk about the bat kol. And I always love that image, right? You all have it from the old cartoons of, right, the character who's trying to figure out what to do, and there's the angel on one shoulder that's saying, do the right thing, go this way, and then there's this very seductive devil on the other corner saying, oh, you should go this way, this looks like more fun, and figuring out, does this heavenly voice, or this voice, the daughter of a voice, play one role, the other, or does it sort of shift throughout life, and what might that sort of teach us about the ways that we make decisions and the voices that we hear? So I thought we would sort of dive right in. I'm actually going to sort of, we'll start, the first text is just a very, very brief place. And so they're all texts from Gemara. I didn't bring a lot of supporting texts. There's a couple of comments here and there, because I'm actually just more interested in sort of how we experience it and our reflections on the bat kol. And I will say that the first, well, setting aside this first little introductory text, the first text, the first two, are the ones that are probably the most common. So my guess is that some, if not everyone in this room, has encountered one or both of them already. But as I always say, I tell a lot of stories to little kids, and whenever I start, they're always like, I know that story! One of the things I say, and that you all know as learners, is that you can encounter a text 100 times and find something, hopefully different in, 95 of them. So if someone wants to read for us in Hebrew or English, it's just a brief snippet sort of about the bat kol and I think an overarching idea of in some ways, and we'll discuss if we agree the way the rabbis saw this sort of bat kol, divine voice. So we're on the first page if anyone wants to read for us.
Our sages taught, when the last prophets, Isaiah, Zechariah, and Malachi died, the divine spirit departed from Israel. Despite that, they were able to avail themselves of the bat kol.
Great. So, some of us are probably familiar already with, the way the rabbis view the end of prophecy, right? That after the destruction of the temple, after the death of the prophets, that prophecy is sort of handed over to children and fools is usually the way. It's the most famous text on this, but this sort of brings in this other idea. So any responses, reactions, what role does the bat kol play here?
Replaces the divine spirit.
Replaces or
succeeds.
I've just been wondering since you started about bat kol, that it's not quite a voice, it's related to a voice, so this is like less reliable than
Right, it is not a malach, right? It is not an angel, it is not a divine voice. I love that language actually, it's like related to a voice, like not quite a voice. And I think you're right, right? I think I'm not sure it replaces prophecy, and I think even the afal pichein, right, despite that, even with that, they were able to mishtam shin bevat kol. Like it's not somchin, it's not rely on, right? Mishtamesh is to use, to avail yourself of. It's actually often used in talking about intimate relations between husband and wife. So there's some sort of intimate relationship with the bat kol, but it's not clear, you know, that the bat kol really plays this role of prophecy. It's a relational voice. So I like the idea that it's related to a voice. The other piece that I think is interesting here, and the reason I sort of put it as an introduction, but I think is that it does, again, with the word relate, right, it does connect the bat kol somehow with prophecy. You know, that this idea of, okay, so we had these final prophets and we know the role of the prophets, but now we don't have them. And this, I think there's sort of this underlying question of like, so what do we have, right? Where do we turn? You know, if, and I think especially for the rabbis, right, if we're enmeshed in the text and we're still in sort of a moment of not being sure which way to go, where can we turn if we don't have prophecy that is sort of a living, breathing prophecy right now? And they set up this idea that maybe in those moments we can turn to a bat kol. And so one of the questions that I will sort of leave out there that we'll maybe come back to is the bat kol something that we turn to, or does it sort of appear when we might need it most, or maybe when we might need it least, depending on which text. So I'm going to sort of leave that as a question and move on to, as I said, probably one of the two most familiar instances of a bat kol. So we are in, this one is in Eruvin 13b. And so I'll start, Shalosh Shanim Nechalku Beit Shammai Uveit Hillel. Right, so this sort of classic story that for 3 years, the schools of Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel were at odds, were engaged in ongoing debate. And sort of, you know, one of the questions that comes up is, what were they debating? And there's a lot of commentary on, were they debating a specific point of law? Or were they debating sort of an entire halachic system, an entire way of looking at the law, an entire way of making halachic decisions? I think you'll see where the bat kol comes out on what it was. And one school, Omrim Halacha Kamotenu, right? One says, the halacha, whatever it is like us, right? We have the right interpretation. And then, of course, the other school is going to come out and say, what?
We
have the right interpretation, right? Sort of the ultimate debate. It's he said, I suppose, in this case. And then here we go. And you'll notice this is the phrasing almost every time. Yatzah bat kol va'amra. So a bat kol came forth or came out and said, and this is the famous verse, right? Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim chayim chayim. That these and these, both what Beit Hillel is saying and what Beit Shammai are saying, are words of Elohim chayim, this living God. But v'halacha k'Beit Hillel. But the halacha is for Beit Hillel. So what role here is the bat kol playing? Is it a prophetic role, or is it something different? Right, it's like a halachic decisor. Right? It's sort of the bat kol comes out as the mara da'atra, as the one who's going to ultimately make the halachic decision. So it's not a prophetic voice. It's not saying this should be your behavior, or this is what you're doing right or wrong, or, you know, here is the way back to the path of God. Maybe that's ultimately what the bat kol is saying. But here it's saying you two are in a debate. This one, you are, you know, it's a like great rabbinic answer on some level, right? You are both right, or at least you are both speaking divine words, which I think is a really important statement in general for study and debate L'shem Shemaim, but also, but this one is right.
It's not even this one is right.
Right, you're right. It's this one has the correct interpretation of the halacha.
On the other hand, since the Gemara is sort of derived from Beit Hillel, it's almost like they are using this idea of a bat kol to validate the way they've chosen to go.
So that's a very important statement that I want to hold on to over here, because I think, right, one of the questions that I started with when I started sort of looking into these texts is, so what do the rabbis do with the bat kol? Here, you'll notice there's not really any debate with the Bat Kol. It sort of comes out, it says it, and, you know, those of us who've encountered this sort of know that, yes, most of the time, all except for, what is it, six instances, the halakha is Kaved Hillel. And so the Bat Kol seems to be making this overarching statement that the rabbis are comfortable with.
I'm not exactly sure what the Bat Kol is.
So we started sort of with, right, the Bat Kol, the translation is a daughter of a voice. And it is sort of, I always, and I think part of it is because of the way it's described of Yatsa Bat Kol, that the voice of the Bat Kol sort of comes forth, that it is the sort of supernatural voice, I'll go with it, right? It's unclear, is it a voice of God? Is it an internal voice? That is never made clear. It's never explicated. For me, because of the language of Yatsa Bat Kol, I sort of put it as, you know, this sort of external supernatural voice comes out.
Yeah, it seems to me what the Bat Kol says a little contradictory to the facts, because they said they were kindly and modest, but yet it says the halacha is as we say, and the other school said the halacha as we say, so we don't see evidence that they were modest and kind to the other school.
Right, in this particular instance. So I was just telling someone about this the other day. I'm a big watcher of Top Chef. And one of my frustrations when I watch Top Chef is the judges, at least on the surface, claim that they are judging on that day's competition alone, right? That they don't bring in historical experience with any of the contestants. Here, I think you sort of have the opposite, right? That the editorial voice who's sort of putting in this note about what Hillel and Shammai do and why that decision is made, because they are taking sort of a million other instances. So here, you're right. Here it seems like they are having the same, you know, this one saying I'm right, this one saying I'm right. And I think what they're experiencing is other times that we see Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. And as Gloria, right?
Yeah.
As Gloria said, it's also, and I think, you know, this is, I always say it's part of why I love the Gemara, is that they tend to be very self-aware and self-conscious. They are sort of making their own arguments. And so the fact that almost every time you encounter it, the halakha goes according to Beit Hillel, they also are sort of underscoring that here.
I'm just curious, how do they know it was the Bat Kol that this came out? Does it announce itself? Is it like a voice that everybody hears? Is it a voice that one person hears?
So,
like, how do you know? So that's crazy.
Always the question, right? Also, I always wonder that, and we know, you know, there's a whole Jerusalem syndrome of people who are sitting there being like, no, I heard the voice from heaven. So I think it's a great question that I'm also going to hold on to, because I think, at least in the next text, it's slightly more clear, at least the second part of who hears it. You know, here it's not clear who's asking, right? So this is one of these cases, no one asked for the Bat Kol, right? Neither Beit Hillel nor Beit Shammai says, can someone back me up here? And out comes the Bat Kol. Here they seem to be arguing, and whether the Bat Kol is annoyed by the argument or, you know, but no one seems to ask. And so it sort of is, that's why I think of it as this sort of supernatural, you know, comes down and is like, enough, you know.
Where would inspiration fit in? Or something, let's say Herzl, someone like Herzl, who, you know,
oh, in terms
of Israel, let's say.
So is the Bat Kol a visionary voice, is what you're asking? Let's see. I mean, I would say here, not necessarily, right? The Bat Kol is not presenting something radical, new, different. Here, as I, you know, the Bat Kol is sort of coming down as a halachic decisor, or a halachic advisor, perhaps. You know, and I don't know, because I think when we think of sort of visionary, and I just spent a couple of days on a retreat about vision and visionary leadership, you know, we think of really the prophets, right, who are out there asked by God. I think the other piece that's a little bit missing here is, again, who asked the Bat Kol? It's not humans saying, hey, can you answer us? And we don't, at least in the Gemara, see God saying, can you go down there and decide this for me, because it's getting annoying listening to them argue for 3 years. We don't see either of those pieces. Do you want to? Okay, you're good. Okay. Any other thoughts on this? And the second part, and I didn't get your name in, at the end.
Robin.
Robin. Oh, we have two Robins. You know, who brought up is that presumably it is also the Bat Kol who is giving the answer about being kindly or modest. That's not as explicit. Most of the commentaries I've seen read it as that the Bat Kol is explicating that, but somehow there's this now conversation with the Bat Kol. I like to imagine it's like Beit Shammai being like, wait, why does Beit Hillel get this one? You know, like, why are you coming down and taking it away from me? And so this answer, right, that they are kindly and modest and they study and it's, but so I think that's sort of, in this, usually that's the most, the part of the text people study. I think here it's actually the sort of lesser importance other than it sort of give credence to why a Bat Kol might come out and say this.
Don't you find it a little disturbing, though, that it wasn't decided based on the merits of the argument, but rather based on the merits of the people arguing?
So maybe. I mean, I think some of it is, again, back to this question of what actually were they debating. And I think based on the second answer, because we don't know, right? It doesn't say. And the next one, we'll see that it's a specific question of halakha. Here, it's not a specific question. So I think what they're sort of coming down on is on an overarching, right, that the Gemara will go, I can't do the math, I'm going to say 6 out of 10 times, 9 out of 10 times is going to go with Beit Hillel. So it's less about the particularities of the halakha, but rather about the way one studies and comes to halakha. And that I think it does add a certain sort of like idea of humanity within the conversation. And for me, and, you know, there's a little bit of bias of the way I study, I think it also really does leave room for spirit of the law versus the letter of the law sometimes, right? That it allows for Beit Hillel to come in and be able to say, like, maybe I might have thought this, but I'm going to actually look at it in the way it has us interact with each other and the way we study it and the way we question it and the way our conversations go, and therefore the halakha goes with Beit Hillel. I actually sort of like the answer. Because it takes it less, I mean, there's plenty of detail in the Gemara, but here I think it does give us a bigger framework for how we study and learn together.
And the beginning part of the Gemara, it seems like they both had truth to what they were saying, so it's not like they were arbitrarily picking one of
right.
them, not keeping in mind the halakha of what they were studying, and they're just like, oh, in fact, it's going to go according to Hillel just because he's modest, and not give any kind of, and not take it seriously what they're arguing about. It seems like they both had valid arguments, and that was like the...
Yeah, beautiful. And I think that is true. I mean, I think, and again, the second text of the Bat Kol is a very different text of it, and I think here you really do see what it means for people to hold two competing and maybe equally valid truths. And if you have to make a decision, what can you take into account in addition to the fact that both, I mean, I think this idea that Elu ve'Elu, right, that they are both, you know, words of the living God, they're both sort of divine truths on some level.
It seems to me that the Bat Kol is asking for a more pragmatic approach, an approach more sensitive to social living. I think it just makes sense.
Great.
Do it this way.
Great. So I'm going to have us, we're going to now look at the next instance, which is a very different, both a different instance of the Bat Kol and also a very different reaction. So this is the one that's like the first time I learned it, and still every time I learn it, I love. I think there is so much richness in this story. I think it's probably why it's on every single, you know, top 10 stories you have to learn from the Talmud. I've never seen a list that didn't include this one. So this is known, as I said, I think, number of you have encountered it, called the Oven of Achnai or the Tanur Shel Achnai. This is an interesting one because it is the case of a very specific halacha. So you have Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua who are arguing over basically the kashrut of this oven. If it's been broken and mended, can it still be kosher? And what's the... And so Rabbi Eliezer says one answer and Rabbi Yehoshua says another. Rabbi Yehoshua sort of represents here, and I think this is interesting because it is different from Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. Rabbi Yehoshua, as you'll sort of see as the story goes on, represents like a majority rule. He sort of has everyone on his side, and Rabbi Eliezer sort of represents this singular voice of like capital T truth.
Rabbi Eliezer's verdict, if I remember correctly, was the stricter one.
Yes. so stricter, right, which is also interesting in the context because Beit Shammai is usually the stricter one. So does someone want to read for us? Starting with, it has been taught on the second page.
It has been taught on that day, Rabbi Eliezer brought forward every imaginable argument, but they did not accept them. He said to them, if the halakha agrees with me, let this carob tree prove it. Thereupon, the carob tree was uprooted and moved 100 amot. Some say 400 amot. One cannot bring proof from the carob tree, they retorted. Again, he said to them, if the halakha agrees with me, let the stream of water prove it. Indeed, the stream of water flowed backwards. They said to him, one cannot bring proof from the stream of water. Again, he said, if the halakha agrees with me, let the walls of the Beit Midrash prove it, whereupon the walls inclined to fall. But Rabbi Yehoshua rebuked them, saying, if students are engaged in a halakhic debate, why should you interfere? They did not fall in honor of Rabbi Yehoshua, and they did not stand upright in honor of Rabbi Eliezer. They are still standing just in
court. All right, I'm going to pause you right there before we get to the denouement, right, the dramatic moment. So, reactions.
I think he's asking either for a miracle, and then with the walls of the, I'm thinking he's endangering them. They're sitting there learning, and he's asking the walls to incline, or...
So he's asking for miracles, and I mean the important, like where the story hinges is what happens. He's receiving them, right? Like it seems like there is no question that he is correct, like that he has the right interpretation of the halakha, right? He says, you know, literally, like, let this, you know, let the laws of nature be flouted in your face, and they are each time. And, you know, what is Rabbi Yehoshua's response each time, which I sort of love? Right, that's not good enough. And then where I pause, Jane, is this sort of great moment where, you know, Rabbi Yehoshua was like, wait a minute, forget, you know, find the carob tree and find the stream. They might have moved, but that doesn't prove anything. But you didn't even win it with the walls because they didn't actually fall down, right? Like Rabbi Yehoshua seems to be like looking for some little, a foothold on which he can sort of still hold his ground, and sort of saying like, oh, but the walls, you know, they didn't actually fall. So maybe it is sort of one of these questions where we both have competing truths or correct interpretations because the walls only inclined. So they went halfway. And so maybe, you know, I don't think Rabbi Yehoshua is really into compromise. I don't think Rabbi Eliezer is either, but you know, maybe there is this sort of space for compromise and they sort of leave it open with that. And then, Jane, do you want to finish where I cut
Rabbi
you off?
Rabbi Eliezer returned by saying, if the halakha agrees with me, let proof come from the heavens. A bat kol came forth and said, why do you dispute with Rabbi Eliezer, seeing that in all matters the halakha agrees with him?
Okay, great. So, mm-hmm. No, we're going to pause there. Huh?
I think it's troubling. Before you said that nobody asked for the bat kol. And here, he didn't ask for the bat kol. First, he's asking for these miracles. It would be different in my eyes if he asked the bat kol immediately. But by asking for miracles, I see a certain arrogance, to be honest.
Okay. I know Rabbi Yehoshua would agree with you, by the
way.
Who is Rabbi Eli? Who is Rabbi Yehoshua rebuking?
It actually seems that Rabbi Yehoshua is rebuking the walls themselves, or rebuking the students for sort of turning towards Rabbi Eliezer. It actually appears the walls themselves, sort of saying like...
I mean, it was Rabbi Eliezer who said, let the stream of water do this.
Right.
Why does it say Joshua is rebuking Rabbi Eliezer? Why does it say them?
Because he's rebuking the walls.
He's rebuking the
world. Yeah, he's sort of rebuking the laws of nature to some extent, sort of saying, and this really will come out at the end of the story, Rabbi Yehoshua is really sort of saying, like, it's in our hands now.
Right.
Right? We as the rabbis, we are the deciders of this. Why are you Mr. Carob Tree, and why are you Mrs. Stream, and why are you Walls of the Beit Midrash getting involved in this? You have no business in here. Leave us alone. So he's not actually rebuking Rabbi Eliezer at this point. I mean, the whole thing is, for him is a rebuke to Rabbi Eliezer, but here he actually is talking to the laws of nature, sort of saying, stay out of it. Like, you know, which I think later, I mean, I think it's like the most chutzpahdik thing he does, right? Just sort of say, stay out of it. This is our business now.
I think that Rabbi Eliezer asked for the Bat Kol because the miracles were not convincing enough.
Right. Right.
So, and it got about as clear a statement as you could get.
Right. I mean, it's you know, from a narrative point of view, it's a great story as well of. You know, this didn't work, and this didn't work, and now, and so this, I think, goes back to what you were asking of, like, who here, you know, he, and here, and this is why I like it sort of in contrast to the Elu Ve'elu story, the Hillel and Shammai story, right? It's not that the Bat Kol just sort of decides. This is really Rabbi Eliezer sort of saying, like, okay, well, none of this worked. So if that doesn't work, I mean, what is the best proof you could possibly get? A voice from heaven, right? And here it's interesting because I think they're more, here it is more explicit on what a Bat Kol might be because it doesn't say, can a Bat Kol come forth, right? It is min hashamayim yochichu, right? That from heaven, you should be rebuked, right? Let it come from heaven that I'm right. And, you know, there's lots of ways of proving yourself in Gemara, right? If you can sort of go back to a Baraita, that's a good start, right? If you can go back to Torah, that's an even better start. But, I mean, what could be better than an actual voice out of the heavens coming down? And so, you know, so here Rabbi Eliezer is actually asking, saying, like, can someone out there help me? And I think this sort of idea, like, can someone out there who everyone else is going to listen to, or at least maybe hear, help me. And so, indeed, the Bat Kol comes down, you know, says, not only, and interestingly, so, sort of similar to the other Bat Kol, like, not only is Rabbi Eliezer right here, right, not only is this stricter interpretation right here, but Rabbi Eliezer is right in all matters, which is sort of, that's a tough statement, because presumably there's probably sometimes he's actually wrong, right? Humans and fallible. So, in the first story, what is the response to the Bat Kol in the Hillel and Shammai debate?
It decides on Hillel.
Right, decides on Hillel, and at least in the recorded text, no argument. Right? Right, and then it just sort of goes on, and so I think the sort of assumption of like, okay, we've accepted it.
Yeah.
Right? So, at least from that story, you know, and I know there's no earlier or later, but we're studying one first and then another, so we'll go with that. You know, in that first text, the Bat Kol seems to be an authoritative voice. You know, and I think in the text that we're looking at now, the question of authority is an enormous one. And so let's now look, Jane, do you want to keep going or you want to pass the torch?
Rabbi Yehoshua stood and exclaimed, Lo vai shamayim hi, it is not in the heavens. What did he mean by this? Rabbi Jeremiah explained,
there's my typo.
The Torah said, the Torah had already been given at Mount Sinai. And so we do
need, it's actually do not need, I, that's
so
my typo.
We do not need to pay heed to the Bat Kol, for it was already written in the Torah at Mount Sinai. After the majority, one must incline.
Okay, so we're going to pause there. For what I think is really like one of the most chutzpahdik responses that I ever encounter in Gemara, right? You have a voice from heaven that comes down and says, this is the correct interpretation of the halakha. And this time, right, Rabbi Yehoshua doesn't say that's not good enough, right? You know, at first with the tree and with the stream, Rabbi Yehoshua was like, you can't have proof from a tree or a stream. That's ridiculous, right? The laws of nature have nothing to do with our decision on halakha. Here he can't really say that, right? He can't say you actually can't get proof from a Bat Kol because it is a voice from heaven. It would be pretty hard. So what is his response here?
A voice from heaven has no authority.
Right. I mean, like, talk about chutzpah, right? And to use Lo Bashamayim hi, right, this brilliant verse from Deuteronomy about, you know, when Moses at the end and talking to the Israelites and saying, so, you know, when you say, like, the Torah is too far from us, who should go and get it? If it's, you know, at the depths of the sea, who will get it? And Moses says, Lo Bashamayim, it's not in the heavens. It's sort of in your heart and in your soul and in your lips, and it's yours to teach and to own. This is, like, the most extreme example of that. Right? Because now, Lo Bashamayim, he doesn't, I mean, I don't think Rabbi, I'm like pushing it a little on Rabbi Yehoshua. I don't think he really believes this, right? Like, it's not even a partnership now. It's literally been handed over. That a voice from heaven has no authority in this conversation because Torah has already ruled. And what's the ruling that he gives? Right after the majority. And so, Robin, I think this actually goes back to this, Robin, to what you were saying about the earlier, right? So, again, it's not, the halakhic decision isn't necessarily about the truth or correctness of the halakha, but the system for determining it. So here, there's this sort of majority rules, right? So that even though Rabbi Eliezer is a sort of lone voice, and he's a stricter voice, which is an interesting argument in and of itself, they're saying it actually doesn't matter that he's right. We've come to this other place. So it is. It's, I always find this a pretty bold text. And then, of course, the great finale. It's actually not the finale. We always end it here, but the story actually is much sadder as it goes on. But let's. We're going to end it here because I wanted to focus on the bot hole. What is? How does the story end?
Okay. So Rabbi Nathan met Elijah and asked him, "What did the Holy Blessed One do with that hour?" The Holy Blessed One laughed and replied, "My sons have bested me. My sons have bested me."
Right. I get chills every time I read it, imagining, you know, God looking down and being like, they kind of beat me at my own game there. Right. If I said Lo Bashamayim He and I said after the, right, this idea of like, I kind of gave it to them and they ran with it and all right, you win. You know, well played. Only, of course, the story becomes tragic and Rabbi Eliezer is excommunicated and he died. I mean, it's this very sad story that I think ultimately sort of comes back to argue against the Nitzchuni Banai, right? That you have bested me in the logic game, but that's not necessarily how I wanted you to play it, I think. That's always how sort of I read God in this scenario. Of you won, like, well played, but I'm not necessarily so thrilled with being bested.
I've heard an alternative translation of Nitzchuni by Rabbi Riskin, which is, my sons have made me eternal. So the...
Oh, for Netzach.
Yeah. And so the theory is that by having a halachic system that can grapple with text and interpret and keep things moving, you made Torah continue on and be relevant throughout the generations.
I like that. Borrow that from Rav Riskin as well. I like it. I like it a lot, actually, though I feel like it loses some of the dramatic emotion of the moment, which could be a good or bad.
But they could both be true.
They could, right. There we go. More competing truths.
The last paragraph, you're saying that you're interpreting that basically God is saying he's not really pleased with this outcome?
I think it is a sort of sardonic laughter, yeah. Because, I mean, and I play that, and to be fair, I didn't include the whole text, so I didn't include where it goes. I don't think God is happy with the way Rabbi Eliezer is treated after this moment.
So he wasn't happy when he was excommunicated either.
The way Rabbi Eliezer is treated, but the argument for majority rule versus any kind of a priori or logical solution, isn't that the subject of this last little?
Yeah, I mean, I think, so I'm trying to think, I'm thinking like as a, when you as a parent give like rules to a kid and they figure out how to turn them for their own advantage, mm-hmm. right? And you sort of have both the like, you beat me at my, right? But like you have a little bit of pride of like, wow, that was smart. Like you did that well, but also like, like you sort of, you moved the rules of the game a little bit. That's how I picture God in this moment. You know, that like, again, I think because it is so clear throughout the story that Rabbi Eliezer is correct. I mean,
I still go back to thinking, I don't think his behavior is correct, asking for the miracles. As I said, he asked for three miracles before he reached out to the Bat Kol. So I don't like that, and that's why I said that's arrogant to me.
But it wouldn't be arrogant to go to the Bat Kol first?
But that's a legitimate authority. It's like being a vigilante versus going to the police. Taking things into your own hands. That's just how I see it.
I've always thought that God is pleased because he wants it to be, the Torah to be decided by the majority, by the rabbi, by the people. It's down here on earth, and we have to do it. That's our job. And we our judgment isn't perfect, so be it. But it's our job to do this. And the miracles, whatever you call them, was that God's plan? That's sort of a sorry. The Bat Kol is in the same category. I mean, it's like a mystery. It's a mystery. But God likes this system. He wants us to decide what he gave us the Torah, and now it's up to us to make whatever rulings are required to make it work.
Okay.
And that was always my understanding. Obviously, it's not the only possible interpretation. Maybe God was not too happy about it. This is a new idea.
Yeah, I think God is not displeased. I think it is the sort of conflicted laughter, right? That I think that God is absolutely, there's this real pride of like, look what my kids have done. Like, they took this and they figured out and they sort of monkeyed around with the laws and made it work for them, and that's awesome. But I think what's hard is, there's still the Rabbi Eliezer piece. And also, how do we play with how do we answer the fact that, three times, God's own workings are the ones sort of speaking to Rabbi Eliezer's correctness.
But it proves, by having these three times and the Bat Kol rejected, then the rabbi, the majority is saying, or Rabbi Joshua is saying,
the majority,
that's it. This is the system we're using. Because if you didn't have the miracles, it wouldn't be so convincing. So Yoshua's statement would have been, this majority says this. Majority says this is not good enough. It has to show, majority is so powerful that it beats the miracle, it beats the Bat Kol, it beats everything, it beats God.
But first of all, I think theologically that's a pretty radical statement, right? That it actually beats God, right? That like...
Okay.
No, but I'm saying, I think that's where the sort of conflicted laughter comes in, of God saying, yes, this is, Rabbi Hoshua, you are brilliant what you have done, but also, like, it's a little, I would think, even for God, and I think especially in this translation of Netzach, which of this eternity, right, to literally say the divine voice has no authority is a very challenging statement. Right? I always think Rabbi Hoshua takes it like one step too far in saying it that way. Right, that we have no need to pay heed to a divine voice.
To me, I think it means that you need to argue decisively back and forth and back and forth. And then finally, the majority agrees. And you have to go with the majority. Full steam once the argument is over. However, God is in the background, and that majority might be wrong. So that's the lesson to me.
Isn't it also somewhat of a clear statement by the rabbis that they're the ones who are going to be in charge, and not so much taking the power away from the heavenly voice, but taking away from the people who, or anybody else who might want to have an opinion? I mean, this is just a power grab saying we're in charge.
I mean, I think it's a statement of a system, and a system that I mean, we can debate, like, worked in the sense of a majority, right? That, and I think, again, sort of going back to the Hillel Shammai debate, that I think, again, it is probably less about the particular truth or untruth of a halachic decision than about how we get to making the decisions.
Just thinking, you mentioned gaming system and gamification is a hot education.
Yes, it is, right. And, right, you could actually imagine this being gamified, right? Of like, how does Rabbi Eliezer prove his...
there are two ways. One is like gamification as in computer games, but also alternatively, people get in the news when they game the system and they get caught. I mean, for example, there's supposedly a family of Jews and somewhere in Brooklyn or whatever, that supposedly gamed the system for loans, and now they were indicted or something like that. The outcome, not necessarily. They may have gamed the system, and maybe what they did was not illegal. But I'm a former computer educator, and one of the traditional Jewish communities up in northern New York gamed the system, so they got internet money for their school system, which in theory might have been fine because they used the money to buy Torah books or whatever, but it was supposed to be for internet usage. They never even connected to the internet because their whole tradition is against it. So you could argue that with back and forth.
And I think in some ways, right, so I think the Nitzchuni Banai, and I think in both contrast and complement to the Hillel and Shammai story, that the Bat Kol and the Nitzchuni Banai sort of represent that you can be right, but not always good, right? That I think, and again, where the story goes is that, like, Rabbi Yehoshua is right. Like, that is the system, and he is correct, and that is the way it's going to go. But that there can be real tension inherent in that.
Who she was right.
Right. Yeah.
I just think that one thing I wanted to say is, so in the first piece we read, the Bat Kol just kind of came because there was a 3-year argument. And in this piece, I very much relate to the fact that there was a majority and that was the rule, but this man was right and he stood up for being right, and the Bat Kol. So in theory, God is saying, if you're right, you should stand up for what you believe in. You should keep arguing that you're right, and like the heavens will be on your side. So it's a nice little thought about, standing up in the face of everyone telling you that you're wrong, but you really believe you're right, that God will support you. How he can. You can't beat men who are the majority of the system and will later excommunicate.
Right. I mean, and I think right. I would want to rewrite the story right at the end. That rather than excommunicate Eli, you say keep it that way. Right, but I like the idea of like, okay, so Rabbi Eliezer, like, we're going to figure out some way to sort of keep your voice, which the Gemara does, right, because it records that Rabbi Eliezer actually is right, that his halakha is correct, even though we're going to go with the majority, and that, that is sort of the ultimate decisor.
But you're saying the system is working. So if we went with Rabbi Eliezer, everybody who had an argument would say, "Oh, I'm going to ask for a miracle to prove it," and that's not the way the system should work.
Right. Not to mention, we would think probably the miracle wouldn't work every time.
Yeah.
Because he actually was right.
Is there any chance, to a slightly cynical way to read this? Is this like a lesson for people later about how they can vote for Bat Kol? Is like it's used in the first instance where we already knew how it was going to be decided. So then we kind of bring out the Bat Kol and we say, well, we knew where to go with Hillel, and then here God supports Hillel. And here it's like kind of the opposing views trying to bring the Bat Kol, and the rabbis by putting it in are saying, well, we're not going to accept it. So almost like, don't bring a Bat Kol in Jewish arguments if you're the minority, because we're not really going to accept that, but it works if you're the majority and you can add it on top.
So you'll see, that's great. So, and apparently I have 5 minutes, so we're going to like fly. I'm going to even just bring your attention to the rest of the text. But so I said only Gemara text. I actually brought like 2 commentaries, one from Noam Zion, who writes really beautifully about these two discussions, and then this one from Rabbi Lewis Jacobs, who writes that there is a lot of medieval commentary about why the bat kol is heeded in the Hillel Shammai and ignored here. And sort of the consensus is, sort of what comes back to what you said, right? The consensus is that a heavenly voice, you can't appeal to the heavenly voice to decide matters of halakha, right? That because the system is that it, the lo bashamayim, that it was handed over to rabbinic authority to make decisions of halachic importance, but that in non-legal matters, and I think the Hillel Shammai case is an interesting one because I think it sort of underscores that it probably wasn't actually about the halakha, but rather about how they reacted with one another and treated one another. In non-legal matters, we are supposed to heed a bat kol. So what I want to close with is I loved this text. It's from Ta'anit 29a. It is in the midst of a discussion about Tisha B'Av. The Mishnah is all about Tisha B'Av and what happens on Tisha B'Av. And so it is sort of based on the idea that the city was plowed up, that the city was destroyed. And so you start with this teaching. When Tornus Rufus, the wicked, destroyed the temple, one of my favorite characters, it says, Nigzarag Zera al Rabban Gamliel Lahariga, that Rabban Gamliel was condemned to death as the leader of Sanhedrin, that he was the one who was going to be condemned to death. And this general comes out and stands in the Beit Midrash, which I think is interesting, right, that he goes into the Beit Midrash, which is, of course, where Rabban Gamliel is the leader, and says, this is just the nose man is wanted, the nose man is wanted, which I'm sure, like, was not... It's an interesting thing as we read it, like, knowing our anti-Semitic tropes, that they actually think that it's a play on... that the word would have been the nasi, right? That we use nasi, which is very similar to a Roman word for nose, so they think it's probably a scribal confusion. And that when Rabban Gamliel hears this, he goes and he hides. And the officer goes to him in secrecy, and this is sort of a fascinating turn, and says, if I save you, if I am able to save you from this decree, will you bring me into the world to come? And Gamliel says, sure, that sounds like a good deal. Like, I can figure out a way to make that happen. And the officer says, will you swear it to me? Which I think is sort of an interesting request. And that Gamliel again says yes. We could probably spend an entire hour talking about that interaction in and of itself. So the officer throws himself off the roof and dies. And then, this is what I love, right? They sneak in. I feel like this, if I was writing the narrative, I would have put this at the beginning so you sort of know it. Turns out that there was a tradition, a Roman tradition, that if a decree was announced and one of the people who announced it dies, the decree has to be annulled. That it's sort of leader dependent as opposed to system dependent. And so here again, is that the bat kol comes out. Yatsta bat kol va'amra comes forth and says, Oto hagamon, this same officer, mizuman l'chaye ha'olam haba. That this officer is indeed invited into the world to come. And so I loved this because I think there's a lot unspoken to the bat kol here. And by the way, this is where the sugya ends. There's not a debate with the bat kol. It just sort of, it goes on to the next piece of the Mishnah. So we seem to be in a similar situation to the first one. This idea that here I think, the bat kol is coming forward to sort of offer an answer that is not really halachic, but that probably runs counter to what the majority would have thought. And so I think this story is sort of an interesting middle ground between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai and the Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yehoshua. That here, there's not a debate, right? The bat kol is not coming in to settle anything. The bat kol is not coming along to say, this one's right and this one's not right, or this one's right and this one's right, but we're going with this one. Here, I think the bat kol is coming to say, like, this is something that is going to be challenging for a lot of you. Like, it runs counter to a lot of other teachings, but here is the right and the just thing to do. And so I think it's sort of an interesting...
Presumably a fact.
Presumably a fact. But I think a fact that would probably be surprising to the Beit Midrash, right? That you would think that this Roman general, really, like this Roman general who hasn't done any of the mitzvot, right, doesn't live by our system.
That's why the bat kol had to come and say.
Right, exactly. But so I think it's sort of an interesting way to close. And so, do I have like 30 seconds? So I came across, this is the last thing I'm going to say that I think, in thinking, so what I started with was this idea of like the angel or the devil on your shoulder. And I think the bat kol can be both. The bat kol can really challenge, and the bat kol can support what we already think to be true, in different cases. And so I'm going to close. It was a teaching I came across when I was teaching for Parashat Vayera, about the malach at the end of the story, right when the angel comes down to stop Abraham. And so it's from Dvash HaSadeh, so it's like an early 20th century teaching. So why was the order not to slaughter Isaac given by a mere angel, whereas the command to sacrifice was pronounced by God? Right? Why does God is the one who says, take your son, but it's the angel who says, don't do it? And I like this. It teaches us that we must not obey anyone, even an angel, and I'll add even a bat kol, who commands us to harm someone. But when a command is to desist from doing harm, the word of an angel is sufficient. So I'll leave you with that, and enjoy your day of learning.
Oh, I had a question about that.